Welcome to the MMQB podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I am here with Andy Benoit. And Andy, we have a show for the real connoisseurs this week. We are going to talk safeties and safety play.
Well, that's the thing. That's the thing that all quarterbacks examine first when they look at the film.
Yeah,
is what does the opponent do with their safeties? So if you're into football, this is the position for you. It's a versatile position. It hinges on the scheme, or the scheme hinges on it. And if you're not into football, then I don't know why you're listening to the show.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah. Although when I just said safeties and safety play, it sounds like some sort of HR presentation we're about to go through, but it's not. It's safeties. It's the most versatile and interesting position on the defensive side of the ball. So it will be an interesting topic. We are going to count down the top 15 safeties in the NFL today. We are also going to hit up the mailbag. But first, we are going to take a trip around the league, look at some of the big stories going down right now in the offseason. And there's some fascinating stuff, starting with Ryan Fitzpatrick. It just keeps on turning. Very slowly, but it keeps on turning. Fitzpatrick apparently has an offer in hand, 3 years, $24 million. You know, both sides sort of threw out what they thought of the valuation of the contract as far as guaranteed money. Apparently, $12 million in the first year, $6 million in each of the next two. It sounds a lot like a starter contract for a year and a backup contract for the next 2 years. I don't know if you have any thoughts about what the Jets should be doing with Ryan Fitzpatrick, or whether you think they are doing him wrong.
No, they're not doing him wrong, because it's a meritocracy in the NFL, and it's very capitalistic, aside from the salary cap, I guess. And every guy gets paid what he's worth. And so if Ryan Fitzpatrick were worth more than this, and he's probably worth less than this, because he has, if someone else came and matched the offer, he'd probably sign with them out of, we hear all about his principles these days. Mm-hmm. He'd probably sign with them out of principle. Clearly, no one else is offering Fitzpatrick this amount of money. If the Jets, if there's anything for the Jets to do, and maybe they're playing around with fire if they do this, but if we're talking dollars and markets, if there's anything they can do, it'd be lower the number now.
Yeah. You know, it kind of bothers me that there's absolutely no loyalty, and it's so cutthroat. And, you know, the stuff, the old, you know, Patriots cutting ties with Lawyer Malloy, and that stuff bothers me to an extent. I understand it all. It just bothers me a little bit. The weird thing with Fitzpatrick is I know he's a very likable guy. I mean, look, those years in Buffalo were wonderful until they were not so wonderful. But he was in New York for one season, and he played very well for about three quarters of that season, and he happened to have a pretty big meltdown in the biggest game of the year against, of all people, Rex Ryan. So I don't know, to sort of look for that, what's the reverse hometown discount, hometown premium, or whatever he's looking for, it's just a little bit odd. It's a little bit off. I think a less likable guy would be taking a whole lot of heat right now for this. If Geno Smith was doing this, if Geno Smith had that season last year and was going through this, yeah, you know, I don't know if people are going to be getting behind Geno Smith.
I agree. That's a good point. I think it's totally within Fitzpatrick's prerogative to do this. So he's not holding out. He's unsigned right now.
Yeah.
And so he feels he's worth more money. There's pretty much zero chance he's going to get more money. And he'll be lucky if he gets what these numbers that we're hearing about, if he gets those. So I don't know what happens next here. My guess, Gary, we hear guys all the time, they sit out or they threaten to sit out. How many guys have actually ever done that?
Yeah.
And I'm talking holdouts and guys that just wouldn't play in their prime. They wouldn't play for less money. I mean, Carson Palmer did it. And for different reasons. Mm-hmm. And Sean Gilbert in the 90s did it as a holdout and actually sat out the year. I can't think of anyone else who's done that. And both of those guys were much better at their job than Fitzpatrick is at his.
Yeah. No, not off the top of my head. I can't give you another name there.
Guys don't do that. It's every offseason we hear this type of stuff. But $12 million to play another year, you really think any starting QB would take zero instead of $12 million and do nothing?
Yeah.
And he's not worth more than that, by the way. People keep saying, they keep ranking where he is in the market. If we were to rank every NFL starting quarterback, Fitzpatrick would come in about 25th,
yeah,
maybe 20th, depending how generous you are. So the idea that, well, he's getting the median of quarterbacks or the average or the low end of whatever, It's the markets decide what you're worth. Every other team had a chance to sign Fitzpatrick this offseason.
And there were teams that needed a quarterback.
Right, and they still didn't sign him.
So yeah, that continues to go on in New York. Meanwhile, Geno Smith is both the most likely guy to start week one as the roster currently stands, and also the most likely guy to get let go if Ryan Fitzpatrick finally comes to terms here with the Jets.
Do you think so? Do you think you just get rid of Geno Smith?
Yeah, I mean, they're not going to carry four quarterbacks. And you're going to keep Petty. And Petty and Hackenberg, obviously, they're the two guys that the current regime brought in. Unless they saw something, unless they thought Bryce Petty was a complete disaster last year. And there were no, you know, there were no whispers of that. But obviously the fact that they drafted Hackenberg tells you they are also not sold on him as a quarterback of the future.
Yeah. Yeah, the Jets are in a weird spot with their quarterbacks right now. It's not, you don't see this kind of scenario very often.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll move on to another quarterback situation, and one that will make Andy Benoit sound especially smart today. Carson Wentz, apparently ahead of Sam Bradford as far as learning Doug Peterson's offense. And everyone had sort of written Wentz off, and Andy Benoit, along with a couple other guys, Greg Cosell, Mike Mayock. Was there anyone else in that group, Andy, that you know of?
Not that I know of.
They were saying Carson Wentz is ready to know this offense. You said flat out before the draft, Carson Wentz will learn this offense as quickly, if not quicker, than Sam Bradford, because he has that kind of football IQ. Right now, granted it's early, but right now it looks like your prediction is looking pretty good. Would you like to take a victory lap?
Well, what people don't remember is that Bradford hasn't played in this system either. So they're both transitioning to new schemes. Yeah. Now, Wentz is transitioning to a new league, and maybe things will change once we start seeing some actual competition. In these OTAs and mini camps, you don't necessarily feel the heat of the NFL competition yet. You can tell things are faster, but you don't actually have to face that things are faster in the same way as you would in real games, certainly. So maybe things will change. I don't think they will. I think Wentz is going to win the job because he and Bradford, intellectually, they started out on equal footing here. So if that's the case, then why would you not play the number two overall draft pick, the younger guy, the guy you are going to build your team around? Why not get started on that right away?
Yeah. I mean, the only reason I think you'd hold them back is if you think your skill position players are so unsuited for what you want to do that you think you don't want to create any sort of bad habits, put them in bad spots. I mean, outside of Zach Ertz, it's not a very good receiving core at all. Quite possibly the worst in the league.
Yeah, it's not a great unit, but that scheme is so, a scheme is schematically driven, but it's so mechanical. it's highly schemed. They don't ask their receivers to win one-on-one battles a whole lot. They do sometimes on the weak side of a formation, depending on the coverage. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time, it's a defined read with the routes dictated by the coverages, and certain the ball goes to wherever the type of coverage demands it goes. They've got an answer for every coverage they see. It's coverage beating routes. It's not out executing you. It's out leveraging you. So I don't think they want good players instead of bad players, but I don't think they would be hesitant to put anyone out there based on who they have at wide receiver, because they believe the scheme can take care of a lot of it. That's why in Kansas City, Peterson's previous stop, they didn't necessarily hightail their chances to go get a wide receiver. They got Macklin after a while, but they were content playing with cheaper guys for a long time.
Yeah. And look, on the defensive side of the ball, they are ready to win games. We're actually going to circle back onto the Eagles when we do our safety countdown. They're going to have two safeties in that top 15. I think in the top 10, but we'll get to that when we get to it later in the show. Next up, Rob Ryan and Rex Ryan had some words for Jenny Rentis on our site last week's Talking Football column. The two brothers were very Ryan-ish in their interview with Jenny. So I'll read a couple quotes. Well, I'll read one quote for now. Rob said, "I need to be in a multiple system. I was hired to be in a multiple system in New Orleans, and I did a damn good job and got fired for it." Now, he was a little bit all over the place. He sort of backed off that and then went sort of circled back and came a little bit stronger on it. It was a very free-flowing interview with lots of swear words.
When Jenny handed in the story, did she have the swear words included and make you guys have to put, I assume we put dashes in stars and some of the vowels, if I'm not mistaken. Did she make you guys do that, or did she type the, did she do that for you?
I think she left them in. That's a really good question. I'll buy some time for a second and look that up. If I remember correctly, and you can, you've been here since day one, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe Jenny Vrentis is the only person to swear on the MMQB podcast.
Yes. I mean, to swear where you'd have to bleep them?
Yes.
Yeah, I think she is. And she didn't mean to do that. she probably is mortified that we're sharing this.
Well, no, it was there. It was not only, I remember when that episode came out, it was last training camp, and I can't remember who she was referring to, but yeah, it slipped out and it was used as the teaser. That little, I don't think we really do it anymore, but you know, the little, in the theme song to the episode, you do the little, you know, the outrageous things that are said. And yeah, that was the teaser, was Jenny swearing.
Well, if you spend as much time around the Ryan brothers as Jenny does, and she has a great relationship with Rex, Ryan, then you're going to pick up a little sailor tongue after a while. It's just going to happen.
Yeah. Okay, so I have the original file up here now, and I'm looking for... Yeah, she left all the dirty, filthy words in there. S word and the F word and whatnot, and we dash them out. I guess that's our style. I don't know if we ever really had a style on that. But yeah, we...
I liked it as a kid growing up, reading, because you'd count the dashes and try to figure out in which way that you knew the word, but you wanted to know which way they applied it.
Yeah.
You know, was there a Y at the end, an ING at the end, whatever it might be.
The F word is always the best for that, because there's so many different combinations it could be.
Yep.
But anyways, Rob Ryan, I guess I'll just ask you flat out.
Well, wait, what was there? You were going to read a quote, and I interrupted you, I think.
Oh, did you?
I guess the quote was about he needs to be in multiple systems. You read it.
Yes, and he said, I did a damn good job, and I got fired for it. Damn, we did not.
Yeah, no, we left that in. I agree with what he's saying to a certain degree. Now, he was so all in... You, Gary, we've been in the room with Rex Ryan before, and you know how these guys talk, and there's a little bit of beat in the chest and gorilla stuff that comes out all the time. And that's just the nature of them, and that's probably why their players love them, and it's a plus and it's a minus, and it's going to go that way. That's just how they communicate. So there's some bravado here by Rob Ryan, and with bravado comes hyperbole. But at the 30,000-foot level, what he's saying is not wrong. He did a great job in New Orleans. They went to the playoffs his first year, and he was a big reason why. And he was a hero around the French Quarter, and that was it turned so quickly. Now, what we need to wonder, though, is he's a good coach, and I think he's right about doing multiple schemes. He's good when he does that. He's not as multiple as his brother has been, but that's been a little bit of his circumstances. But you do have to wonder after a while why he's not keeping jobs, though, when he is doing a good job.
Well, it turned on him in New Orleans, and it also did in Dallas.
Yeah, and the reason he didn't keep the job in Dallas is because they wanted him to pare things back. They felt there was too much on their players' plates, particularly the linebackers. Mm-hmm. And they thought that's why we're not forcing turnovers, because it's all about getting stops with all this convoluted stuff, but that we're losing our ball hunting instincts.
Yeah.
And they didn't feel he was the right guy to pair back. I think they asked him to and felt he didn't do it enough. And so they made the change.
Yep.
So Rob Ryan's gone through this before. And at some point the teams take receipt. It's ultimately he's responsible for his career. But at some point when you're hiring him, you have to take responsibility and understand why are we hiring him? What are we hiring him to be and do? And if he said they wanted him in New Orleans to run more Seahawks type of stuff, if that's the case, that's misguided, because the Seahawks scheme works because of the Seahawks players.
Yeah.
It's a scheme that takes a lot of talent. And if you don't have talent, then you have to try to create success some other way. And that's where you get into coaching and trying all this complex stuff. And that's what Rob Ryan's always aspired to do.
Well, I'll bring up two quick things in the interview. Sean Payton shot back on PFT Live, said, quote, "The idea that it wasn't his defense or he wasn't in charge of it is silly." Rob Ryan had also pointed out Jarris Bird as the sort of jumping off point for their change to a zone heavy scheme. They just wanted Bird to sit back there in center field, and that's the way they were gonna play it. They had let Malcolm Jenkins and Roman Harper go in favor of Bird.
Bird's not that kind of player. I know they paid him that way, and actually I was part of the camp thinking he would be when he came over from Buffalo. Mm-hmm. I wasn't as sold on him as some people, but I did buy into the hype a little bit. And in Buffalo, it was a little bit of a different system, and he was a better player. I don't know what happened or what changed. He did get injured once, but he has not been physical on film. The awareness is iffy. I mean, you see bad angles to the ball at times, which you can't have as a center fielder, especially if you're going to play matchup cover three type stuff, which like Seattle does and like New Orleans is going to try to do. So yeah. Anyway, they asked Bird to be Earl Thomas, and you can't ask Bird to be Earl Thomas.
Yeah. I'm going to give you one more. I'm going to give you my take on the Ryan brothers. How's that for a transition right there? Seamless. And I'd just like to know what you think about it. I personally ignore the bravado. I think it's just noise. It's just something that entertains you beyond the field. I'm not saying they're on the right path in Buffalo, but I think they're not on the wrong path. I think to go 8-8 with that team last year with first-year quarterback and Tyrod Taylor, I think that's good enough. I think that's pretty much maxed out for what that team could have done with that roster and that talent. I don't know. Supposedly, this is the big make-or-break year, and I hope Rex gets 4 or 5 years there. And if it's not working in 4 or 5 years, then it's time to move on to something else. But I think the urgency there is artificial and just kind of ridiculous.
Well, what gives me hesitation, and I don't necessarily disagree with you about the 8-8 thing, although this team was 9-7 the year before. What gives me hesitation is that they took a lot of steps back defensively in yeah. pretty much every meaningful statistical category. And you know, I'm not a stats guy, but I'm not dumb enough to outright ignore them. And especially yeah. if they're all saying the same thing, they took a big step back in a lot of ways. They were very good and productive under Jim Schwartz in that 4-3 scheme. And then Rex came in and did, and I don't blame him for this. This is why they hired him. He employed his scheme, which is almost antithetical to the 4-3 basic zone stuff they do. And I thought they looked good at times, but in the big aggregate, this team did not improve over the course of the season, and the scheme looked fragmented in its execution, and the numbers reflected that. So I'm a little more hesitant than you. I think Ryan's a good coach. I think he's absolutely a quality NFL head coach. Mm-hmm. But I understand the concerns in Buffalo about him because they took a lot of steps back defensively.
They did. I'd make one more point, though. That Doug Marrone team, they were an 8-8 team. They won the finale in New England when the Patriots played Jimmy Garoppolo, who was a rookie at the time. They played him the bulk yeah. of that game. So really, you know, if they played that game week 10, they would have lost in New England and they would have been an 8-8 team. But
no, I got you. I got you. Yeah.
So,
but they were an 8-8 team with a good I mean, if this Buffalo team had the kind of defense last year that they had the year before, then it reasons that they would have been a 10-6 team. Yeah. We're just guessing now, but you know what we're saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does it raise a flag? I know we'll get off the Ryans, but they've got 3 rookies that they project as starters, which is also odd if we're talking about a defense that was as good as it was and they're essentially rebuilding it. Does that strike you as odd at all?
Not really. And you know, I don't have any inside information about what went on there, but it seems like there were just a lot of guys who didn't buy in. It seemed like everyone at some point was griping about that defense, especially the guys in the front 7. So
yeah.
It seemed like they had to do something. They had to rebuild quickly. And, you know, they got certainly an NFL-ready guy in Reggie Ragland to play, I guess, maybe the weak side. And, you know, Shaq Lawson, obviously it's a different story now with the shoulder surgery, but he would have been ready to contribute right away. So I'm not surprised they rebuilt aggressively in the draft on the defensive side of the ball, because it just seemed like, yeah, when it boiled right down to it, there were a lot of guys who just didn't buy into what they were doing last year.
Yeah.
Like I say, I'm not a fan of anyone. But if you asked me, if you gave me the truth serum and asked me who I'd like to see win the Super Bowl, I would have said the Bills like the last 5 years. I just feel bad for the folks over there. They're good fans. They need a winner. They need to go to the playoffs or something.
I don't agree. I don't disagree. I enjoyed our time in Buffalo last summer.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good country out there in Western New York. Let's see. Next topic. We got some preseason injuries, offseason injuries to address here. We're going to start with Tyler Eifert. Suffered an ankle injury in the Pro Bowl. Now has to undergo a minimal procedure. Recovery reported to take up to 3 months. Puts his first couple weeks in jeopardy of the regular season.
Doesn't sound very minimal, does it?
That does not. That's not a very minimal surgery at all.
Yeah, my guess is that that phrase came from the team or from Eifert's camp.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, they are without Marvin Jones, without Mohamed Sanu, and now with those two guys gone, how important does Eifert become to what they do? Because certainly he had an outsized role in the red zone last year, but the other guys were sort of used, you know, in between the 20s a little bit more than Eifert was.
I think it's a big role because, and yeah, he was better in the red zone than between the 20s, but that was partly a function of how the scheme played out, partly. He's become a versatile tight end. In fact, when you get in the red zone with him, you can match him up against a cornerback outside the numbers. So basically, you can ask him to play wide receiver, Eifert, and he's won in some of those battles. And yeah. Why that's important, because if you've regressed or downgraded a wide receiver, which you have if you're Cincinnati, mm-hmm. Sanu and Jones on the way out, Brandon LaFell on the way in, that's a downgrade. Yeah. Maybe Tyler Boyd, their second rounder, could be something, but they're going to have to help their receivers out more likely. And to help receivers out, you create mismatches for them through alignment. And look at what New England does with Julian Edelman, for example, mm-hmm. and where they move him around and get him matched up on linebackers or safeties a lot of the time. Well, that's what you get with a tight end like Eifert, especially against zone coverage. You get him matched up on corners, which creates mismatches for your wide receivers. And by the way, the tight end, we said, can beat the corners at times. So yeah, he's an important player for them. And if he's gone, then that's a different looking offense than what they would want and what they would have expected there.
Yep. Yep. Pro Bowl injury, the best kind of injuries.
Yeah, I would never, and I know that's it's moving to Orlando, I guess. So now we've touched on the Pro Bowl, and I would never let my guys ever play in the Pro Bowl.
Yeah.
If I were a team, I couldn't stop them, but I would do all I could to discourage them. I don't know if you're allowed to do bonuses of some sort, like an anti-workout bonus.
Yep.
I would do whatever. It's not worth it. I don't know why you'd play in the Pro Bowl.
Yeah. I mean, the whole big thing with Honolulu used to be everyone wanted that free vacation. It was not that they couldn't afford their own trips to Honolulu, but it's like, you know, since it's in Honolulu, let's go out there. I don't know.
Yeah.
And again, nothing against Orlando, but if you're not a Disney fan, are you going to go to Orlando?
I don't know. I mean, you'd have to have young kids, but yeah. Mostly it's the guys in their late 30s that'll have kids of Disneyland age, because guys in their 20s probably don't have a 7-year-old.
Yep. Amir Abdullah in Detroit underwent surgery on the torn labrum, could miss the rest of the offseason. So he was probably penciled in atop the depth chart there in Detroit, even though he's not a guy Dan Quinn brought in. He was another high running back pick that they made, and at least for 1 year it didn't work out. It seems like what they kind of did in the Martin Mayhew years there with their backfield. What did you see from Abdullah last year, and do you think he's the kind of guy that they could have built that running game around?
Well, yes and no. We know what type of runner he is, and I think Bob Quinn, their new GM, understands that and is cool with it. He's a finesse type of runner. He's going to have to make you miss. He's not going to run over you, mm-hmm. which I think is conducive to today's style of NFL play. The run game without him, I think really the discussion, because he's expected back at some point, right? I mean, he's going to miss offseason, but we're not talking September at this point, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like at this point, probably him being questionable for week one is a worst case scenario.
Okay. And that would normally be bad with a runner like him who is a little bit raw, and he's only entering his second year, and it's a new, it's technically a new offensive coordinator.
Yeah.
Not really, though, because Jim Bob Cooter was there at the second half of last season.
Yep.
But I know Detroit this season, they're going to have about 5 different running plays in their playbook, and that's it. They are really simplifying the offense and especially the ground game. So I don't think Abdullah is going to fall behind here. This could have been more catastrophic depending on the nature of the scheme. But in Detroit's system, they're going to run, it's going to be a Peyton Manning type of system that he ran with the Colts, not the Broncos, but the Colts. And that scheme, you can plug in and play running back pretty easily because you're not going to be asked to do any plays you haven't run before at some point in your life, probably even back in high school.
Yeah. Yeah. And finally, on the infirmary report here, Byron Bell, dislocated ankle, season over. He was not going to start at right tackle, at least in Tennessee, because they brought in Jack Conklin with a top 10 pick. But Bell had some versatility. He was a guy you could plug in at a couple of spots, played some left guard last year, played some right tackle, made a start at left tackle. Is this going to hurt them at all?
I hope he's okay. Again, the big picture, I root for him, and no, mm-hmm. it's not going to hurt him at all.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a backup utility lineman. They have other good backups there. I like Quentin Spain, who's a guard. I don't know if he could play tackle as well. But no, this is, with all due respect, this doesn't move the meter a whole lot.
All right. We're coming back in 30 seconds with the mailbag. And after that, we will rank the top 15 safeties in the NFL. After that incredible Game 7 victory over the Thunder, Steph Curry and the Warriors meet LeBron James in the NBA Finals. Two people who know the NBA better than us are SI's own Ben Golliver and Andrew Sharp. They're watching every minute of this massive rematch, and they'll have all the top storylines ready for your morning commute. That's Open Floor, SI's NBA podcast. Find it on si.com/podcasts or your podcast app of choice. Andy, do you take any offense to that ad read that Ben Golliver and Andrew Sharp know the NBA better than us?
No, but give me a little time because I've seen all but I think three NBA playoff games this spring, which
there
I don't know how I've done that. I watch them on DVR and I fast forward through free throws so I can get them done in about an hour. But I've enjoyed these NBA playoffs. And actually, before I got into football, when I was younger, until about my late teens, I knew I was more of a basketball guy than football guy.
Okay.
I knew basketball more. It's easier to know. There's just fewer guys on the floor and less space. So there's not as many hidden factors. Like we're going to do safeties, count down the top 15 safeties. You can't just watch football and know everything about safeties. You can't see them on the screen, for one. Yeah. Basketball, you don't really have that element. So it's more fan friendly in that regard.
Well, when we were kids, everything was just ISO, ISO, ISO in the NBA. So it's a lot more interesting now. The things that they do.
Good point. Yeah. They had that illegal defense rule for a lot of years and everything was, you're right, everything was isolated. It's a fun league now.
Yep. Yep. Before we jump into the mailbag, I just wanted to give, and this is going to be my second big compliment for Andy Benoit on this podcast. If you haven't checked out Andy's story on Chris Harris, where he goes one-on-one against Chris Harris, the Broncos superstar cornerback, of course. It was fantastic. It was one of the best things I've read in a while. I think easily one of my top five favorite stories at the MMQB since I've been here. And my wife repeatedly asked me this weekend, what are you chuckling at? What are you laughing at? And it was always, I'm editing Andy's thing. It's really good.
Well, I appreciate that a lot coming from you. Thanks. It was fun to write it. And it was just a matter of which angle of portraying my humiliation I select in writing the thing, because there was really nothing else behind the story other than athlete versus wannabe athlete and everything you expect to play out played out, only much worse.
Yeah. And I'll just have one more thing. Jim Butts and John DePietro, our video guys, put together a really nice companion piece with Andy's story. There is a scene. So, you know, Andy writes about, I won't give away the whole thing. Andy writes about the double move he plans on pulling on Chris Harris on the very first snap that they're going to run against each other. And on the video, you see the double move. And when you have the low angle, it's kind of like, oh, whoa, Andy's moving pretty well there. And then it cuts back to what would be a little more, it's a little bit higher than usual, but it's a more traditional broadcast angle. And you see the two of you going downfield, and it's kind of like, oh, whoa, they are not moving very quickly at all.
And the other thing I noticed was that pasty white wide receiver really didn't lay out for the ball on that first throw. And in his defense, to him, it felt overthrown and he was sure it was. And then when he put on the film, he thought, oh, my goodness, is that really what happened out there? That was a good, well-thrown ball.
I was going to ask you, if you knew that was going to be your best shot at a monster game, would you have laid out?
No, because I didn't think about, oh, I'll have other opportunities. I knew that was my best shot going in because I knew he's not going to bite on a double move. If he's going to bite at all, will be on the very first time.
Yeah.
And he also didn't have his cleats on yet, which helped. I didn't have mine on either, though. and he changed into cleats after that, which I took as a compliment. But the point there, the reason I didn't lay out for the ball is because I didn't know I was supposed to. I wasn't very good at tracking it.
Yeah.
And I just didn't make the play. I got open and didn't make the play.
Well, the entire piece is fantastic. It's much more than that. We didn't spoil the best part, though that was a good part. It's on the MMQB. Me versus Chris Harris is the headline. Check it out. You will not regret it. But it's time to reach into the mailbag. As always, Andy and I, very available out there. We're on Facebook. You don't even have to like us on Facebook, actually. I think you can just message us on Facebook. I mean, if you really want to make official that you like us, you can also like us on Facebook. You can get us there. You can get us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or ggramling_si, or send an email to talkback@themmqb.com. If you can, I'm just asking that you put podcast in the subject line. And someone had asked us, I'm actually going to look this up real quick. Someone basically said, well, why don't you just get a separate email address? Peter Kimberg, who writes in sometimes. Why don't you just get a separate email address, podcast@themmqb.com? And I can't handle another email account. I have like seven that I have to check regularly. So we're just not going to do it for now. And Kaylin Kaler, very nice of her, helps us out and forwards stuff along when she sees the podcast email. So if you can, talkback@themmqb.com and put podcast in the subject line. It's just a request, not a requirement. But we will start with someone who did put podcast as the only word in the subject line. So he's our favorite person today. This is Gerard Fitzgerald. His question is, if Josh Gordon was eligible for your top 15 receivers, where would he have ranked? And I guess Gerard actually points out, heck, he might have been eligible, which I guess technically he was. We could have ranked him if we really wanted to do, but...
You know, honestly, I forgot about him. I didn't even consider him. He hasn't played in like a year and a half or 2 years now. And
well, apparently he's also 260 pounds and hanging out with Johnny Manziel, so...
Which makes him like triple Manziel's weight from what I hear these days.
Yeah.
Look, I had an argument with a guy I really respected NFL Films, Sean Coffey, who was a producer of the Playbook show for a lot of years. He played at Mizzou in the Brad Smith years as a wide receiver. He knows wide receiver play as well as anyone in the league. And about this was a year Gordon, I think, led the league in receiving. He thought Gordon was the best wide receiver in pro football.
Yeah.
So I thought he was going a little bit far on that. But the point was that was the discussion. And that's a guy that knows receiver play better than I do. So to answer the question, Gerard, I would say he would have been easily top 10.
Yeah.
Probably top five. But I didn't even remember him. I mean, it's amazing how fast guys just fall out of the picture in pro football. Like if they're not there, you don't toil and wait for him to come back. It's just that's the end of him. Next guy, let's go.
Yep. I always like to remember guys sort of at their ceiling and assume they're going to be at their best when they come back from these things. Josh Gordon, I don't think he's coming back. And if he does, I'm sure he will never have the kind of year he had in 2012. But when he came back in 2014, I mean, even then, granted, they didn't have the best quarterback situation in Cleveland. But I mean, he looked sluggish. He wasn't as explosive. He's leading some plays on the field, dropping some very catchable balls, especially in big spots on third downs. I don't know. I mean, that Josh Gordon would not have been close to the top 15. Josh Gordon of, I should say 2013 rather than 2012. Yeah, he was a top 10 guy.
Yeah.
And by the way, Gerard added, I think that you should further weigh your votes for the position rankings. Andy, multiply by 3, Gary by 2, and Jeff Irwin by 1.
Well, I don't, we've talked about Irwin the last few weeks, and we've just come to understand that he's going to have at least one, probably two, but definitely one air ball of a pick on his top 15s. And last week it was not putting Dez Bryant, top 15 wide receiver. He had Adrian Peterson, number 10 at running back. He's going to have one again this week. So what Gerard suggests really was just redistributing the points to make Irwin less powerful.
Yeah.
And it actually makes me a little less powerful because now my vote's only worth half again of yours. But that might be best for the greater good of the whole thing still. I'm with them on that. Jeff Irwin is right now out of control with these advanced analytic statistics.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll get behind that. We'll have to powwow and figure it out. But yeah, I would keep you as twice of me, especially once you get to, we'll talk about today, the safety stuff. You really need to break down a lot of all 22 tape to understand safeties and how they play and what their value is. And you also have to have an understanding of what they're supposed to be doing in each scheme, which I can do some guesswork. And I watch a little bit of all 22, but not nearly as much as you.
And keep in mind, it's hard for scouts as well, because they have that same problem.
Yep.
Scouts will tell you, they'll watch a safety on film, and they might only have 6 or 7 plays that give them any kind of meaningful, substantial information. So it's, you'd think there'd be a lot more busts at the safety position just because of that, in fact. It's amazing that teams are as accurate in drafting safeties as they appear to be, because I'm looking at our list here, which we'll get to right after this next item, and there's a lot of former first-rounders. Some of them are corners that have been converted, but
yep.
A lot of first and second rounders that did pan out real well.
Yep, yep. Our second, and actually our only other mailbag question this week, we will do a turbo version here. This is from Twitter, Neil Hansen at BTBAMRules310. Love the podcast, but why is the typing so loud? And I'll handle the front of this. We were looking for some innovations in podcasting, and much like in TV, they use the helmet cam or the pylon cam, that sort of thing. We decided to go with the keyboard mic. And we mic'd up Andy's keyboard, and will it catch on long term? Only time will tell.
I don't think people can tell you're joking on that.
Look, Andy has a thunderous keystroke, and I'll leave it to you after that.
No, you're right. I do, and I set the keyboard next to my microphone like an idiot, and I have now gone to a tablet, and I'm using a touch screen, and my guess is
nice.
Neil Hansen hasn't heard any typing from me today.
There you go. I haven't heard any on the headphones here. So
it was 100% my fault.
Well, there you go. There was also some weird, and you may or may not have heard this, there's some weird background noise. Someone was, best I could guess, I'm here in the SI podcast room. Someone either right above me or right next to me was watching Cloverfield on the IMAX or something like that. There were loud, loud movie theater noises coming in. Or perhaps the Cloverfield monster had appeared in New York and it had all come true, and that's the noise I was hearing. But there were some very, very loud, distracting sounds last week.
All right. Well, we've pulled the curtain back on pretty much every private thing we do with the podcast, plus Jenny Vrintes and her writing. So what are we doing next? Are we going to do the safeties now?
There you go. Well, we're going to take a 30-second break, and then we're going to do the safeties, Andy. The 115th French Open is heating up. And if the rain dies down, we'll have champions by this weekend. Tennis fans need to keep up with SI's Beyond the Baseline podcast with SI executive editor John Wertheim. John is pulling triple duty in Paris, reporter for SI, analyst on the Tennis Channel, and still hosting his podcast. What a guy. That's Beyond the Baseline, SI's tennis podcast with John Wertheim. Find it on si.com/podcasts or your favorite podcast app. And I think I'm going to hot take John Wertheim for a second. If you said you can only follow one journalist in a certain sport and who would give you the most complete coverage, I think John Wertheim on tennis would be the pick.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
That's high praise. He's a veteran. He's a big stalwart at the magazine. Him and Tim Layton are the guys that are like celebrities within the building.
Yeah. There you go.
And Peter King, I guess. But we get used to Peter, so we kind of dismiss him, you right. and I. But I think people also feel that highly about Peter.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's jump in. Top 15 safeties. This is the next in our series of podcasts, MMQB podcast position rankings. We're doing them throughout the offseason. We have already done running backs, cornerbacks, and wide receivers. Safeties today. If you missed any of the previous three, you want to go back and find them. SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher. You can also, on the MMQB.com, we have the podcast column. All those things are right there. You can go back over the history of the podcast. Or if you already listened to it, just relive some great moments in podcasting. If this is the first time you're tuning in, we do this AP poll style. Andy, I, and Jeff Irwin, our researcher, all cast our ballot of top 15 players. Andy's vote counts as 2. Now, if you get a first place vote, guy gets 15 points. Second place vote, you get 14 points. All the way down to 15th place vote gets a single point. We add it all together and we come up with the definitive ranking of the top 15 players at each position. Safety today, we actually have a tie for 15th. So when we run through the also receiving votes here, this is starting with basically number 17. We have George Iloka with 6 points, Marcus Gilchrist with 6, HaHa Clinton Dix with 5, Kurt Coleman with 3, and Adrian Amos with 2. Andy, any thoughts on any of those guys missing the list or even getting consideration for the list?
I was surprised. Kurt Coleman's played well for Carolina, but he's not in the discussion. I was surprised that Iloka didn't make it. He certainly made my list.
Yeah.
I think he and Clinton Dix will be top 5 or 10, certainly 10, by the end of this season. They're built very similarly, too. They're long-armed, thick-chested guys. And what's key, and we're doing free safety and strong safety together here, and I think that's the right way to do it, because what we're going to talk about was some of these really valuable ones, and I think you get into that with Iloka and a little less extent, but still with Clinton Dix, is the interchangeableness. They can play free safety or strong safety. They're built for it physically, and if you got guys with strong safety size, yet the agility and range to play in center field, that's a rare commodity. And I was surprised Iloka didn't get more money in free agency, got a 5-year, $30 million deal. Because as you know, Gary, the other factor here that we're going to talk about is these are the guys that cover tight ends. And tight ends are more productive than ever now because these three receiver sets create more space for tight ends in the middle of the field. And the NFL, most defenses don't have an answer for the tight end position. There are more good tight ends than there are safeties. And a guy like Iloka can cover tight ends in man-to-man. He's not asked to a lot because that's not Cincy's scheme, but he could do that. He did that a little bit in college. So I thought we missed it on Iloka not being on there. Clinton Dix, I get it, needs to – he's one step away. He'll be top 10 or 5 soon.
I like Clinton Dix. I probably would have panicked and ranked him higher had I known that he was going to fall out of our rankings. I like Marcus Gilchrist, too. I like the way he covers. So
coaches really like Gilchrist. Not just the guys that coach him, but the guys that who see him on film when they're watching other things. He's a guy – he's very versatile. He's a guy who can do a lot of stuff. And that's critical and it's key in Todd Bowles' system.
Yeah. I actually had Gilchrist ranked 10th. I think that's the highest ranked guy I had not make a list. So I guess I'm slightly heartbroken by that.
Well, we'll be all right. So who do we have at 15 here? Because I'm also surprised by who is I can see it. I'm going to let you introduce it. But I'm surprised by one of these guys. I think we all got him too low, and I don't know how to rectify it, though.
Tied for 15th, we had Eric Weddle and Morgan Burnett with 8 points apiece.
And Weddle's the guy I think we are underserving here.
You think so?
Yeah, it's easy because when these guys leave their team and Weddle's now in his 30s and he goes to a new team, he's been in San Diego a long time. He's only 31, though. We think, oh, well, they're old and washed up. 31 at safety, you're not even close to old and washed up. I mean, there have been Pro Bowl safeties that have been 35 years old. John Lynch was very good in Denver for a lot of years in his mid to late 30s. Rod Woodson was another guy who was good in his mid to late 30s. So you can play safety. In fact, the position is so built on intelligence. And with Weddle's case, he's as smart as anyone in the league at his position. And he's good at pre-snap disguises. You can get by with all of those things. I think he's going to be a huge pickup for Baltimore, much like what Steve Smith has done for their offense. I think Weddle will have that kind of impact on their defense. I wish I'd ranked him higher. I went with more of the snazzy younger athletes. I didn't have Burnett ranked. He's fine to me. But I think Weddle, I understand how he gets lost in the shuffle of a ranking like this, but for all intents and football purposes, if we're to take the sexiness of the athlete out of the equation, he's probably a top 7 or 8 safety still.
Yeah, you had Weddle at 12. I didn't rank him. I had mixed feelings about it. And ultimately, I was just scared off by the fact that he is a little bit older. And on top of that, he missed most of last season. So that's why I dropped him out. I had him 17, actually, and Irwin did not have him ranked either. So we had Weddle and Burnett tied at 8. TJ Ward with 9 points coming in at 14. A little more one-dimensional than the two guys behind him.
Yeah, I would agree with that. He's not as good in space as those guys, but he's a better tackler and hitter than either of them. And he's another one who can play man-to-man on tight ends. We don't think about that with Ward because he's not – we don't think cover guy when we think of TJ Ward.
Yeah.
But if you watch the film, he does that a lot of the time. He plays in certain scenarios when they need it. They have certain matchup elements. Ward will cover the tight end. And he's been successful with that. So I know they like him there in Denver a lot, and especially the big hitting. He has the respect of his teammates. I don't know if he's a great communicator necessarily, which is can be a problem when you have a guy in at the safety position, because they're often calling. They can see the field better, so they're the ones calling stuff, adjustments or what have you. So he's not great in that capacity, but the rest of his game, he's not someone you want to play against. I mean, you're aware that TJ Ward's out there if you're playing wide receiver or tight end and going over the middle.
Yeah. Now this next guy, I will introduce him. I will make a quick comment and then I will get out of the way because I think you have some strong feelings here.
This is Irwin's face plant for the week here.
13th is Patrick Chung, a guy who, look, I probably would have had him somewhere in the 30 to 35 range is my guess if I went out that far. He's better than he used to be. I'll say that about Patrick Chung. He's better than he was 4 or 5 years ago, the first Patriots stint and the Eagles stint. But why does Patrick Chung not belong on this list?
Well, I hate to address it that way because I agree with you 100%. He is better than he used to be. He's become their slot corner. Now, that's not going to last because they drafted Cyrus Jones. So we assume they want to go in a different direction there.
Yes.
In a bind, they had him play slot corner, and he did a really good job. Very physical. It was good press, good use of hands. He's a lot better than he was early in his career. Having said all that, he's not a top 15 safety. I mean, I think I had 30 guys listed out as well, maybe 25 that I was picking from, and Chung wasn't even in my consideration there. Maybe he deserved to be. But he's just there were more good safeties in the league than I realized once we did this list. And Chung just isn't that kind of player. I don't, you know what, though, Gary, the more I'm thinking about it, the less angry I am with Irwin for making this pick.
Oh, because there you go.
I think it's over. Well, what he did, he put him way, what do you have, like six or seven, you said?
Yeah, he had him six.
So, see, that's the problem. That's way too high. But I look, it because he did that, we're now discussing Patrick Chung. And how many guys can we say got really better in man-to-man coverage late in their careers like he has after being a journeyman for all intents and purposes for early in his career? So I admire and respect Patrick Chung, and I don't want to rip him. But I do want to rip Irwin, though, for forcing. We shouldn't be forced to talk about these guys, and that's what Irwin's done here. He twisted our arm.
Well, look, that's the other thing with Patrick Chung. I thought that first year back in New England, he was playing a little more man coverage and he was playing better, but he was generally covering second-tier tight ends. He wasn't getting very many challenging assignments. But like you said, last year, they had him out in the slot a little bit, and he held his own.
Mm-hmm. And that actually, they started doing that the year they won the Super Bowl. They started doing that a little bit. I remember because I talked to Chung at Media Day about covering, being a better cover guy. But yeah, I don't know where the skill came from either. That's what's weird, because he always looked like a linebacker, an undersized linebacker, miscast as a safety.
Yep. And look, this was an interesting conversation. My bigger problem with Irwin having him six was he had him in front of Devin McCourty, and I think that's just...
Yeah, we both do, because McCourty's not even going to be our next couple of guys here. We're at number 12 right now.
Yeah. Just to recap real quick, so TJ Ward, you had him 14, I had him 12, Irwin had him 15, he came in 14th on our poll, Patrick Chung, not ranked by Andy or myself, and he was 6th for Irwin. That brings us to number 12, Reggie Nelson. You had Reggie Nelson 15, I had him 13, and Irwin had him 10. Another guy who changed teams.
Yeah, he's a good, and here's another guy in the 30s who can play.
Yeah.
And he seems, he is a good split safety cover guy, meaning cover two or cover four, something where he is responsible for a middle half of the field, but not the middle of the field. Mm-hmm. That's where he's at his best. He's also, and he wasn't used this way as much last year, and he probably won't be in Oakland, but just for discussion's sake, he's also a very good edge blitzer out of sub packages.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I would say we talked about him a little bit earlier in the offseason, and nice pickup for Oakland.
And by the way, another guy who was not good early in his career, and then the light bulb went on. He was a bust for Jacksonville as a top 10 pick, I believe.
He was, and I didn't watch football as closely back then when he was in Jacksonville. He had a reputation for being a little bit soft.
Well, he went and played for Mike Zimmer. And I think a lot of cornerbacks and safeties, more corners and safety, but a lot of defensive backs really find themselves when they play for Mike Zimmer. He might be the best DB position coach in the NFL. And he doesn't do that anymore as much, but he's a defensive back whisperer.
Yeah.
Okay. And he was actually, I said he was top 10. He was actually the 21st pick in 2007. Still a bust for the Jaguars. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. So Reggie Nelson at 12, at 11 was 16 points. Tayshawn Gibson, who was a guy who only appeared on Andy's ballot, and he was 8th. He was
really?
Yeah.
He no was one else eight, was with me on that, huh?
He was 18th on mine. I had him outside the top 15. So tell me, what do you like about Tayshawn Gibson?
I used to agree with you guys more because I thought he had a lot of turnovers, but a lot of them were circumstantial. The ball was tipped to him or something like that, which you still credit the guy for making the play. Look, I know after playing Chris Harris better than anybody, the ball gets in your hands. That doesn't mean the play's over and you've won. You still have to do something from there. So I didn't think Gibson was the playmaker that his numbers said he was. I changed my mind after talking to people who coached him in Cleveland or coached other positions but had him on their defense in Cleveland and how valuable they felt he was. And that kind of just shifted my thinking a little bit more was the Browns felt he was that kind of player. And that's important because I think it influenced some of the calls they make. And that's what a difference maker is. That is literally making a difference in some of the calls you make as a defense if you feel good about that guy.
Yeah. So Gibson comes in at 11. Now with 20 points in the 10 spot, Byron Jones. Andy likes Byron Jones so much he had him twice on his original ballot.
I was wondering if you were going to put the theme of this show is just exposing ourselves. I feel like I've done this show like I'm naked at this point. Like I'm just more and more exposed. I put him twice on the ballot. I got him mixed up. And actually, you know what occurs to me now? And I think we're okay. I think I met Rashad Jones on one of those.
No, Rashad Jones was on. You actually, if I remember correctly, you had Byron Jones, Rashad Jones, Byron Jones.
Okay, well, I couldn't get it between those two. I couldn't decide, and Rashad Jones is number 9, so now we're talking about both Joneses anyway. Look, it all worked out all right, okay?
And there you go.
Byron Jones is, we've talked about him every week, it feels like, so we probably don't need to do a whole lot. He's as versatile as they come. He can play outside corner, inside corner, strong safety, or free safety. And he does it all pretty well. There aren't many pieces in the NFL. In fact, there aren't any right now that are like that, other than maybe Tyrann Mathieu.
He might be my favorite player in the NFL, the more that I think about it.
There you go. And he's a Connecticut guy. I get that. I know why you're saying that.
You had him 10th. I had him 8th. Irwin did not rank him, which just breaks my heart.
Yeah, well, we've gone over Jeff Irwin.
This is the first time I've been upset with Jeff Irwin. I'll get over it.
Did Irwin rank Rashad Jones, our number 9 guy?
He did. He actually had him ranked at 9.
Okay.
You and I both had Rashad Jones at 11. So 22 points for Rashad Jones. He comes in at 9. It's been a rock in a really not very good Miami secondary for the past couple years.
Yeah, when he's going downhill, when he's approaching the line of scrimmage, he doesn't have to be at the line. He could be coming from 30 yards back. Whenever he's running towards the action, he's a really, really good player, run and pass. Now, when he's retreating or having to read and truly react, I think he becomes a little bit more of a toss-up. Still a good player, but where his impact is most felt is as an attacker. Yeah. And I would hope that Vance Joseph, their new D coordinator, does something to take advantage of that, because I think not only is Rashad Jones an attacker, but he's not Roy Williams of the Cowboys a few years ago where he's just going to hit the hell out of you. He can also make plays on the ball. He's a playmaker, as they like to say.
Yeah. And more borderline curse words in the show. H-E double hockey stick. It really is. This is an NC-17 show. Andy's naked. We're swearing all over the place. Coming in at 8, our first of 2 Eagles on this countdown, Rodney McLeod, the new guy. 27 points. It was a weird thing. I remember when he signed, and all I could think was, oh, no one signed
nobody
Rodney
noticed.
McLeod?
Nobody noticed. Nobody commented on it.
It doesn't make sense.
Well, he got overshadowed in St. Louis, which is now Los Angeles, but it was St. Louis when he was there, of course. there were a lot of other stars on that defense. And so it's easy to have him get overlooked. But one of the reasons those guys could be stars, particularly the other linebackers and corners, was they had a trustworthy center fielder. And when you do that, you can be more aggressive at your other positions. So McLeod is rangy, and he has ball skills as well. And I think he's a decent tackler in space. So to me, he's a poor man's Earl Thomas. And I don't mean that, like, I'm not saying he's broke or really poor. I think he's a less rich Earl Thomas would be the more polite, accurate way to say that. I think he's really good. And I know other coaches who've gone against him feel even higher about him.
Yeah. No, I think that's very fair. And his new teammate, Malcolm Jenkins, comes in at 7. Actually, kind of a gap between Jenkins and McLeod in the voting. Jenkins, 35 points. McLeod with 27. And they seem to complement each other, on paper at least, very well. Jenkins is a guy who put him over the slot, put him closer to the line of scrimmage, and you got a pretty good tandem there.
And Jenkins is one of a handful of former corners at the top of our list here. Guys that played corner and then converted to safety. And there's been other guys that have had very nice careers doing that. Antrell Roll, who's not going to be in this discussion now, but would have been 3 years ago.
Yep.
He's another example that comes to mind. But Jenkins, that former cornerback, that cornerbacking experience really suits him well in some of the schemes they did under Billy Davis, their previous D coordinator. Now, it's not going to be as big a deal under Jim Schwartz, who's going to be more traditional cover three, cover two. But the point is, Jenkins, with what he's been asked to do so far, has been a good all-around player and coverage and as a run defender up near the line of scrimmage. He sets the edge well. He has this understanding of angles and where the ball's going. And that versatility was very valuable in Philadelphia's old scheme. And I'll be interested to see if Schwartz does anything at all. And if he doesn't, it's not a criticism.
Yeah.
But will he wrinkle his scheme a little bit to take advantage of Jenkins? Because most teams don't have that kind of option at the safety position. But you can play him at cornerback in some scenarios, and that gives you more variety and choices to do other things.
Yep. And a quick recap on those guys. Ronnie McLeod on Benoit's ballot was 7th. He was 9th on mine. He was 14th on Irwin's. Malcolm Jenkins on Andy's ballot was 9. On mine, he was 6. And on Irwin's, he was 5. So there you go. Double Eagles back to back there. Which brings us to number 6. Probably the biggest name on our list here. Cam Chancellor. 37 points.
And I don't know if we need to say much about it. I think people know what Cam Chancellor is.
Yep.
We're a little reluctant to rank him. I didn't rank him. I think I had him 6th, and I was a little surprised he came in that high. He's so good at the things he does well.
Yeah.
But there are some limitations in coverage, and we saw that in the playoff game against the Vikings late in that one. And we saw it especially in week 5 against the Bengals when he was one of his first games back for that game. But he can be attacked a little bit in coverage. Not awful, but he's not great.
Yeah. I'll get to my Cam Chancellor reasoning. I had him highest on our list. I had him 4. You had him at 6, and Irwin had him at 11.
Ooh, that's a little low for me. Obviously, I had him at 6.
I will tie Chancellor into a talk about one of the guys a little bit above him in a moment. But first, I want to jump over to another converted corner at number 5, Devin McCourty, 42 points. So a little separation between McCourty and Chancellor. For a while, I wondered when McCourty was going back to corner. And then I think once they brought Revis in, that no longer was a consideration for the Patriots. But look, I mean, he's real good playing center field. They sort of use him in a lot of that bracket coverage.
And he also comes down and plays man-to-man on tight ends in certain scenarios as well. And that's tremendously valuable. Look, if you're a man-to-man defense, which New England is, it's hard to find ways to be versatile. And therefore, your disguises get compromised. And you're not disguising as much if you're playing man-to-man, but you don't want to be utterly vanilla. Well, McCourty is the biggest reason why they avoid being utterly vanilla, and that there is a little bit of guesswork at times before the snap with what they're doing. And he was a pretty good corner, I thought, early in his career. Then he hit some road bumps, and they decide he's better at safety.
And coming in at 4, Eric Berry. Now, I'll just say this about Berry, and this is part of the reason that I bumped Chancellor up a little bit. Berry got torched by Gronkowski in the playoff game last year. And that's unfair because it's Rob Gronkowski and the greatest tight end quarterback combination in the league. But it was just kind of a reminder that Eric Berry has some limitations, just like Cam Chancellor has some limitations. I think Chancellor is better at the sort of more run-centric enforcer type of role than Berry is. But I'll let you go ahead on Eric Berry.
I would agree. And you can tell that Chancellor's better by two things. One, his body type kind of gives it away. I mean, yeah, he weighs a lot more than Berry.
Yep.
And two, where they play him. And that scheme in Seattle, he's the high hole defender, which means that if you play cover three, that means you have three defenders over the top and four underneath. And he's one of those underneath four defenders, but he doesn't play parallel to the linebackers. He doesn't play very shallow underneath. He takes a few steps back and plays off, and that's because he has run and pass responsibilities. But you couldn't play that way with him if he weren't a dominant run defender, because if you play like that, you have more ground to cover in the run defense, and that's a problem for some guys. It's not a problem for Chancellor. So his position suits his skill set very well, and that's the point. Is that's the same thing with Berry. The Chiefs use him in a lot of ways that are favorable to him, and he can do a lot of different things. Versatility and man coverage is kind of the theme of this list so far. And I think Barry's there, and I didn't think he was great last year either. I know he made first team all pro. I didn't think he was all the way back. I think, to be frank, the reason he made it is because they didn't give him charity points for coming back from cancer, but they were more aware of him because they were watching him closer because he was coming back. Yep. And so they gave him inflated value because they saw him do things that they didn't ever look for before.
Yeah.
But I think Barry's going to be even better this season and the year after. I think he is on his way back to really being an elite player.
And I wondered a little bit. I had Barry 7, and that was the lowest on either of our ballots. Irwin had him at 4. You had him at 3. I hate when people say this, but the Chiefs had that sort of soft schedule midseason last year when they went on the run. And I still think the Chiefs were a real good team. They were a legitimate playoff team. But, you know, I don't know how much Barry was really challenged in coverage as some other guys were.
Well, I think he will be now because they don't have the same kind of depth at safety. They also lost Hussein Abdullah, and Hussein Abdullah seemed like, oh, it's just a guy. But he was their dime linebacker, and before Berry got sick, that's the role he played. He played next to Derek Johnson in dime, and in that position, he was asked to do a lot more just because he's closer to the ball. So I'll be interested to see if they go back to that this season. If they return it, they could play Ron Parker as their backup safety, along with Jamel Fleming, and put Berry at linebacker if they wanted. We'll find out. But I get what you're saying about him not being challenged. I kind of avoid the schedule thing because I think anybody can beat anybody in the NFL, but maybe that's an extreme position to take.
No, that's fair enough. And I do hate when people lean on the schedule, but I don't know. It just sort of stuck in my head and couldn't really get it out. But I think the Chiefs were legit. I don't want to infuriate any Chiefs fans out there. So Eric Berry came in 4, Harrison Smith at 3, a guy who was very good before Mike Zimmer became his coach and is now even better.
And then he got better once Zimmer became the coach too.
Yep, absolutely.
And so he's Reggie Nelson in their scheme, which he plays half field coverages. And when they blitz and they go to the double A gap blitzes, which is their staple, he's often the edge blitzer. He covers a lot of ground in his pre-snap disguises, so kind of like Eric Weddle would. He is one of the best disguisers in the league because of that. The more ground you cover, the better the disguise can be because there's obviously, I mean, it's just that's more options. You know, he's all the way over there. Now he's over here. That's a big disguise. That's what Harrison Smith brings to the table. He's also rock solid in the open field as a tackler.
Yep. Harrison Smith at 3, and we get into the top 2 here, separated by just 1 point at 2. Tyrann Mathieu, 57 points. Mathieu got second place votes from you and me. He got a first place vote from Irwin. And sorry, I'll back up real quick. Harrison Smith went 4 on your ballot, 3 on mine, 2 on Irwin's. So Tyrann Mathieu with a first place vote, 57, second place. Incredibly unique player.
Yeah, Mathieu is as explosive as they come. I hope he recovers from his knee. They're more confident about this knee injury than the last one in Arizona. So I don't think they're too worried about it. I think he'll be okay. But what concerns you about having knee injuries with him is his game is so predicated on sharp, quick change of directions and short area quickness. And both of those things, I think, can be compromised if your knee feels unstable. So we will have to take a little bit of a wait and see approach, but we're all assuming he's going to be fine because we all put him top one or two. And he's as explosive as anyone I've seen on film at the position.
And number one, of course, Earl Thomas, 58 points, first place votes, two of them from me and Andy. Irwin had him at three behind Tyrann Mathieu and Harrison Smith. Earl Thomas, just, you know, rangiest safety. I mean, he's the modern prototype here.
And so let's make that part B of the Seahawks discussion. We talked about Chancellor a second ago, how he is the high hole defender.
Yeah.
Well, the other side of that is if that safety, the Chancellor, if he's playing higher up or deeper back, then your free safety doesn't necessarily have to be in center field. He can be tilted more towards the strong side of wide receivers. So if there's two receivers lined up to the left and one to the right, Earl Thomas can line up a little bit cheated to the left. And now he's more involved with the ball and the routes and everything. All the action goes through him. And that's how their scheme works. And it works because he's so rangy, because if the ball does go back to the right, he can theoretically make up for it and still cover the space. And if it goes to the middle or to where he is on the left, he's very good at jumping passing lanes and understanding timing. And do not show him the same route twice, because he's also extremely good at remembering plays and identifying them again. So that's Seattle's defense in a nutshell. And really, those two guys, Chancellor and Thomas, that's what makes the scheme, I think, more than the cornerbacks and their physical press man on the perimeter. And this is why Jairus Byrd doesn't work in the system, by the way, to bring it really full circle, because you can't, and I'm not trying to pick on Byrd, but we're talking football here. You can't ask just any old guy to do what Earl Thomas does and tilt his coverage to one side of the field more than the other. Most guys aren't capable of that, at least not at the truly high level they need to be. And interestingly, the other guy on our list, Gary, Tashawn Gibson, who's now in Jacksonville. He was in Cleveland, but Jacksonville signed him because they're banking on him being that type of guy, like that Earl Thomas. That's where they're going to play him, is that Earl Thomas role. So he's either going to shoot up our list or drop off of it after this season.
Yeah. I mean, not that I ever hope to see this, but we saw the Seahawks defense didn't drop off too much when Cam Chancellor was out the first two games of last year. Earl Thomas has never missed a game. I'd be fascinated to see what that defense would look like if you took Earl Thomas away from it. Again, I hope I don't see it.
That's a good one. That's a good point. I think it'd be a little different story, but I hope we never have to see it. But he's the key to that defense. And he's the key. I think most coaches would tell you that's the guy that's most important to their defense. Not all of them would say it. There's too many good players to have a consensus.
Yep.
But he's the name I hear the most.
Well, there you go. Earl Thomas tops our list of the best safeties in football. And that is a wrap for this week's show. Thanks, as always, to Jeff Irwin, our researcher, and our producer and editor, Alex Abnos, going to be cleaning this thing up, making us sound half-human on it.
More behind the scenes. Way to go. We're both naked.
There you go. This is, I have a very tenuous grasp of the English language, and Alex makes me sound like I know it a little bit better than I do. But most of all, thanks to all of you out there who listen, especially those of you who listen throughout the show here and are still listening, even when I'm just running through the credits. You guys are the best. If you haven't already, please, please, please subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud or Stitcher. Leave a review on iTunes if you have not already. If you want to follow Andy or I, we're both on Facebook, or you can get us on Twitter, Andy_Benoit or GGrambling_SI. Send your questions, comments, all that stuff. We will see you next week. We will be breaking down some sort of offensive position on the MMQB podcast.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys, and Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.